Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Friday morning. 9:14 is the time. Ray Graff here in for Joe Donahue. It's the Roundtable panel, and what a great panel today. It's, let's see, we have Aaron Pacitti. He's kind of an economist, a professor, and such.
Kind of?
All right, I suppose you are. All right.
Okay. All right, thanks.
Listen, we'll get to the job numbers later. You just hang in there.
I'm so
excited. Relax.
Well, he's the father of hotnomics. I mean, I think
that's right. And we'll have some of that coming up on the program. Albany County DA David Soares is here. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
It's fair to Midland. Judith Enck is here. I apologize for not sending you the topics last night. I didn't see you on the initial list, and then I got watching the Knicks game, and they were dreadful, and then I went to bed forlorn, and I'm sorry. But now you have the topics. Here's a little hint. It's going to be about impeachment. So just hang
I'd like to prepare.
I know. You know what? That's what I admire about you.
But you're that good, though. You're fine.
I'm okay.
And Rosemary Armeo is here, and you're always prepared, right?
Oh, yeah, ready.
Alan Shartok, you're here and prepared as well, yeah?
You mean you send stuff out to people?
For Pete's sake. Well,
not only,
you know, we've
not
had
only that. You forgot Aaron Pacitti's, Professor Pacitti's major accomplishment is he's an accomplished banjo player.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for bringing up the banjo this early in the program.
We do not want to talk about banjo.
It's a no banjo.
I know how David feels about us. I'll just
David and I have
pass.
Actually, if there's banjo playing, it's going to be a mass walkout a little bit later on the program. But, you know, a lot of people have been asking how Joe Donahue is doing. And I talked to Joe today, and I got a little update for you. Joe got out of the hospital on Tuesday, is transitioning to home care, although he despises commodes. He's on his back till at least the 17th, and then hopefully can start moving to get walking again. The good news is a surgeon is delighted with the progress, says he is healing well and quickly. Joe wants to thank everyone for their kindness and caring. He's bowled over by the number of cards, emails, and lovely gifts. Oh, you get gifts when you're injured. Oh.
Can you not say bowled over? You know, the last time.
Oh, he did. He did bowl over. You're right.
It's insensitive.
That's okay. He wrote this. He says it leaves him humble, grateful, slightly bewildered. Finally, he wanted to make sure you knew how wonderful everyone's been at the station. Alan was his first hospital visitor, followed up with daily calls of support, making sure that he has nothing to worry about, other than me guest hosting. And by the way, he says he owes
me. You can't wait to get out of there.
He says he owes me a lot of booze, so this is going to work out for me as well. And he wants to thank Sarah LaDuke, who stepped in to do most aspects of the job, and hers as well. So love to all from Joe Donahue. He's doing fine. It'll be a little while, but he'll be up and he'll be running around if he, in fact, does much running around. But we appreciate everyone's support, and we'll keep you posted as to his progress. Now, down to business on the panel here. If you want to write us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Brief messages, we get a ton of them. Please, no attachments. Somebody called us to task for asking people to proofread, but it really does help when you sort of check what you write, and then we can read it a little better, right? Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right, and I don't get what the objection was. We ask people to read it because sometimes when they leave whole words out or they change words, it means a whole different thing, and then they call us and say, you changed my letter.
Well,
wait a second.
We'll try to be more sensitive. That's all. That's our goal here today. Just go with it. Just, you know, buy the gag, buy the premise. House Democrats are advancing aggressively toward impeaching President Trump, announcing they will swiftly draft formal charges to oust him from the White House before next year's election. Trump, quote, leaves us no choice. That's what Nancy Pelosi declared. He's likely to corrupt the system again to keep power. The articles are likely to mostly encompass the Democrats' findings on Trump's dealings with Ukraine. They could charge Trump with abuse of office, bribery, and obstruction. Now, this is the fourth time in history Congress has moved to impeach a president. Let's first go. David Soares, our prosecutor on duty here, did you see Pelosi's statement yesterday?
Oh, I did. I did. You know, I have to tell you, you know, it's almost kind of like when you're watching a child misbehave and you see the parent losing it and you kind of can see what's going to happen in 2 or 3 minutes and you wince. When this reporter asked that question and she stopped and then turned right around and came back. Now, I'm the youngest of five, so I'm accustomed to that kind of, I know what that means. I just sat back and kind of winced a little bit, and she literally came out there, laid the smacketh down on this reporter, stated the position that, you know, the fact that she doesn't hate this man, the fact that she prays for this man, but called him out on the politics. I thought it was brilliant and perfect tone setting. Do not fall for these traps that the right is going to be laying out for you, because the moment you make this personal, you are now playing on their terrain.
I thought it was kind of quite a contrast to the behavior of Joe Biden when he's in Iowa and a Democratic political opponent, he's actually a Warren supporter, got up and said, "You're too old, you're not in good shape, and you know you got your son a job in Ukraine that he wasn't qualified for," and he just said, "You're a liar," and it was just, he was petulant and weak. It was such a difference.
He sounded like Donald Trump.
He did. Honestly. It was such a difference.
Disagree, Rosemary, our mail. We're going to get into it right now.
Oh, my gosh. This topic was going to come up later, but go ahead. Have at it.
We're going to get into this right now?
All right, I'm ready.
I thought I had a few rounds to get warmed up.
I thought that Pelosi was a picture of power and grace. It made me proud to be an old woman. And then I look at Joe Biden, who's the leading candidate, and I thought he was petulant and petty, and he did not make any points that he should have. It was terrible.
I am tired of watching people who are misinformed continue to repeat the BS.
Oh, no.
And are you saying I'm misinformed?
Whoa, 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 I'm talking about that voter. I'm talking about that Iowa voter.
Let's let David finish his sentence.
That
please.
Iowa voter confronting this man on an issue that I think every American, other than the tribal Trumpists, right, understands is rather irrelevant, right? This man confronts him in that moment. And you know what he needed to do? He needed to do exactly that. Because it's letting us know that when that time comes and he eventually wins and he's the candidate that's going up against the liar in chief, he's not going to be backing down.
That's why we need a woman president. Judith, don't you agree?
I totally agree. And I think Biden's staff have purposely limited his exposure to voters, that he's the least accessible candidate. And I think yesterday we saw the reason why. And I think... You know, the Iowa voter, he started by talking about how much he doesn't like Trump and then said, but I think your son getting this board chairpersonship and $50,000 a month or something. Am I right on that? And he has no background on natural gas issues. You know, I'm not part of the right-wing conspiracy, but I think that's a legitimate question, and there's a legitimate response. And Biden did answer previously saying, this was a mistake, and I'm putting protections in place to make sure that when I'm president, there'll be none of this in the White House. That is the way Biden needs to answer it the next time, because if every time it's this food fight and this challenge for push-ups and this petulance. Yeah. I mean, this doesn't end well for Democrats.
This is chest thumping. Yeah. I mean,
it's ridiculous.
I agree with David in that when somebody says something blatantly wrong, you call them out.
Yes.
There are ways,
but not like that.
There are ways to do that in a non-Trumpian fashion, which I think Biden sank to.
Pelosi do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And you see Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren do it all the time. You can say, no, that's wrong, and here's why, and not get in the person's face and call them a liar.
Challenging them to push-ups. That was so juvenile.
It's like a seventh grade basketball court fight or something, you know?
David, he was not an enemy. He's a Democratic voter. He's actually a progressive.
He's a Democratic voter. You can say progressive, but repeating the same nonsensical talking points. Here's my final point, okay? I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm a New England, you know, blue. Mm-hmm. Democrat, okay? Our party, during the midst of, it could be a hand-to-hand combat, right? We're worried about what we're going to look like, how we sound, when we should be swinging, right? It's almost like watching 1980s WWF when the guy would, you know, he's fighting, he's scraping the eyes, you know, the referee doesn't see, Mr. Fuji throws the salt in the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
This is where we are right now, and this party, this current Republican Party is illegitimate. They are illegitimate. They have no intentions of winning on the merits. Mm-hmm. If you've been watching the impeachment, if you've been watching these hearings, no one is addressing the facts. What they want to do is speak fast, and they want to get their 1 minute gif that they can put on and you know, engage social media on to continue to develop their platform. They're entirely disingenuous. And so this idea that we the Democrats right now are going to continue to be polite and correct, to me, I'm done with it.
Well, Alan Chartok, you're rarely polite or correct. Yes. What do you have to say about
quite
this?
Quite right. And that was a good example of both of those. obviously, Biden's in a tough spot here. People criticize him for being milquetoast, right? Do we all agree on that? That, you know, people say you're not being aggressive enough. And they tell him be more. They tell him be
they
more
criticize
aggressive.
Him for lots of things. I'm not sure. That's like George Bush was criticized.
Low energy?
Papa Bush. Yeah, low energy. I don't associate that with Biden.
If I could just finish, Rosemary. So,
I'm sorry. Just wanted you to clarify, Alan.
Yeah, no, I know. But I waited patiently while you had your say, and now it's your turn. So then the other thing is that the people who were for the more left candidates, like Judith, let's be fair, are always ready to pounce on him for one reason or another. So you can't have it both ways. If, in fact, people do, and they do, Rosemary, I want to assure you of this, criticize him for not being aggressive enough. But you know what's interesting? The American people continually, no matter how many attacks on the guy, support him as the leading candidate. I wonder why.
Well, I think it's fine to be aggressive, but you also have to be smart about it.
I agree.
Rest assured, that question will come up at Biden public events over and over again, drawing attention to his son. And so you have to defend yourself, but I think all of these candidates need to think through the prism of what do I need to do to defeat Donald Trump next November? And I'm a little worried that I think Biden just didn't think of that at all yesterday, but also they're trying to get through the primary more than anything, but they've got to be thinking to November. Stunned
so
silence.
So part of this, you know, people on the left criticize people on the right for being dogmatic, right? I mean, and that's true, but you see that dogmatism on the left as well. That there's just this blind loyalty to whatever it is, whether it's Bernie supporters or Biden supporters, and they're dogmatic. And that's just part of the polarization of politics in this country. And I think now you're starting to see it on the left as much as you're seeing it. I don't want to say as much as you're seeing it on the right, but you're starting to see the beginnings of that on the left, where you have this polarization between the, you know, middle-of-the-road Democrats who think they can compromise with Republicans, who have been a party since, 1980, who have refused to compromise on literally everything. So I think the shift to the, you know, more progressive Democrats and saying, like, we're not even going to try to compromise with the Republicans. Triangulation doesn't work because they don't triangulate. They don't compromise.
Yeah, right.
So let's just forget them. That's a perfectly acceptable stance to take. But the way you interact with voters to convey that has to be more subtle and sophisticated than what Biden did. And I mean, that was just a one-on-one ad hominem attack.
There is a reason why we love Uncle Joe, right?
Is there?
There is.
He's likable
because
enough.
Uncle Joe is, I've said it before, Uncle Joe is the guy who comes over and lets you drive his Trans Am. You know, he's Uncle Joe. He you know, lets you take a sip of his beer. That's Uncle Joe. Yesterday's display is in keeping with Uncle Joe. I don't think he'll be harmed by it. I don't think he'll be damaged by it at all.
Well, it seems like, and this is only my perception, that that video has raised, I don't know if it will raise his positive ratings, but it certainly has raised, once again, his visibility. That video is all over the place.
I mean, that's the Trump strategy, is that you just do ridiculous things to get airtime, and it makes you known and reminds people that you're still alive. And
right. Although Trump does it on purpose. I don't think Biden did that on purpose. Yeah. I think he kind of lost control.
Well, that's not a good thing.
I don't think it's super damaging once, but if it continues, and if it continues in October 2020, it's going to be a real problem.
How is this different than Chris Cuomo freaking out over an anti-fan who called him Fredo?
I'm done with the criticism that is leveled, right, by us as Democrats on other people in this age of Trump, who was super impolite. And you have a whole party that doesn't care and continues to endorse this culture that they now have, this strain, this viral strain in their party. But here we are as Democrats, like, oh my goodness, Chris Cuomo was so out of hand.
He was.
I'm walking much worse, though, than Biden.
Yeah, he was, and he's a journalist, too.
Yeah, no. Right. Yeah.
But we're doomed, again, to my word, but we cannot act like the Republicans. They do it, first of all, much better than we do. No Republican or Democrat who's tried to out-unpolite Trump has succeeded. So that's number one. They do it really well, and we need a counter to it. And being like them is not the counter.
I'm with Chris
I think
Cuomo.
Pelosi was the model.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that, too.
I wouldn't vote for you either.
I'm with Chris Cuomo.
Yeah, well, okay. Thankfully, well, Chris Cuomo's well, not that. Running for office, because that doesn't last.
Anything
it
you
gets
say.
Old.
All right, we have 15 seconds here before break. Alan, you want to tag anything here?
No, I just I'm with David. Whatever David says, I'm for.
Okay, we'll mark that down. And if you would like to agree with David, the email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have David Soares here. We have Aaron Pasitti, an economist of sorts and a professor. Judith Enck is here. Rosemary Armeo. Alan Shartok will be back. Let the record show that our panel of left-wingers are resorting to violence nearly here on the program, but they've calmed down now, right? Everybody's good? No more threats of harm?
Yeah.
Talk of the mean
we're
streets?
We're uniting against you.
I'm just the host.
I have threatened Rosemary to spill her soy latte drink, and she immediately backed down.
I do not have a soy latte drink.
All right.
Mr. Plastic Straw. You.
Hey, let me do the rejoin here, and then we'll...
He's going to get hit over the head with a phone by the end of the year.
I've lost control.
Joe.
Cianecology, stand by. Cianecology economic professor Aaron Pasitti is here. Judith Enck, who is a senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College. Joe Donahue, fan club president, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrators here. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. David Soares, Albany County District Attorney, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. Before we get to the letters, or the emails, if you will, Donald Trump now is changing his public philosophy on impeachment. He says, let's get it over with, do it now, so we can have a fair trial in the Senate, so that our country can get back to business.
Do you remember Brer Rabbit? Please don't throw me in the briar patch. I mean, I don't know if this is anti-Brer Rabbit or for it, but I think it's clear the Republicans are very worried about this trial. He keeps bringing people to the White House. He has his staff making sure wining and dining and ice creaming and doing all that stuff with them. I think this is very dangerous for them, and I think they know it.
He says, we will have Schiff, the Bidens, Pelosi, and many more testify and will reveal for the first time how corrupt our system really is. Now, we have a prosecutor in the House, David Soares, Albany County District Attorney. Let's pretend. Let's do a mental exercise.
Sure.
You have to bite your tongue, hold back the bile. You're the defense. You're leading the defense team for Trump. Okay, this is a mental exercise. Mm-hmm. How are you going to go about doing that in a credible way? And don't say, I can't do it. I want.
No. I think, first of all, I do think that the only thing that the defense has had from the very beginning here is, yes, he's done it, but we believe that the punishment is disproportionate to the crime, right? That's the only thing that they've had, to hang their hat on, because they've been able to independently prove the elements, right, of the allegations without ever having to have a member of that cabinet come in and testify, or without having direct correspondence and transcriptions from the executive branch, because they've been stonewalled. So their case has been made, and if you're the Republicans having to defend this president, the strategy from the very beginning should have been, yes, okay, we'll concede those points. We'll concede those points. And as a prosecutor at, you know, at trial, you know what's going to play very well with your jury. Defense attorneys oftentimes will look to stipulate, right, to certain issues, because if you stipulate to it, it's going to come in, but you don't have the opportunity to harp on it and develop a strong narrative, right? The Republicans should have stipulated at the very beginning that, yes, he committed these acts.
He won't let him.
But it's right. But this comes down to this Senate trial here, right? If a reasonable person who was responsible for defending Trump actually implemented a strategy, we wouldn't even be here, or this trial would be insignificant. But his persistence and his ego and his vanity that will not allow for any kind of reason, because his whole life he's been able to just mow down people and do whatever he wants. In this instance, he put the Republicans, both in the Intel Committee and the Judiciary, in the worst position to defend him. True. And so now that you have this trial that is forthcoming, we know that Mitch McConnell and the rest of the Republicans, they do not want to remove this person. But by the same token, they cannot create a process that would be subject, right, to a lot of criticism, because then they would be as transparently opportunistic and tribal as I think most people believe them to be now. So they have to create an environment during this trial with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They have to develop an environment that speaks of legitimacy and try to figure out a way of saying, okay, maybe censure and not removal.
So I think, David, you're so logical, that means you will have been fired by Donald Trump as his defense attorney, and you're not going to get a new Tesla this Christmas. Mm-hmm. But I think some moderates were trying to get some energy around the idea of censure, but Trump just won't let them because it was a perfect phone call. He still says that. What I noticed yesterday in terms of the response from the Trump re-election campaign is they have a new talking point, which is, and it's been out there, but now they're really hitting home on let the voters decide. You know, these elites are taking your right to vote away from you. These elite Democrats are trying to kick the president out of office, and it really is up to the Democrats. And I think that's why you saw Turley, one of the law professors, arguing to slow everything down. Because if you slow it down, I mean, it is a problem if this goes, you know, to June, July. Then at that point, you know, there's more legitimacy to the argument that you're too close to the election.
Going back to Ray's question, though, the optics of all of this, and independent of the strategy, like, it was, I didn't do anything wrong, and then evidence comes out, and then it's like, okay, well, yes, there was a quid pro quo with the White House meeting, and now Pompeo and Pence and, you know, Mulvaney are all, you know, implicated in this. And just the optics, it's somebody who changes their story about the same question over how many months. It just doesn't look good. It makes him seem like he's running from something and knows that he did something wrong. And so, you know, like Ray said, you know, a consistent and coherent strategy from day one would be what any...
I didn't say that.
No, I'm sorry. The question that you posed about what would be the appropriate
right.
strategy would be... And I'm not a lawyer, I'm a so-called economist, but...
Something of an economist.
Something of an economist.
It's getting worse. Banjo-playing economist.
Yeah, a mediocre banjo player and above-mediocre economist.
Right.
You have a consistent strategy where you have talking points, and you just move that through, and it makes it seem like there's support behind you, and he didn't do that.
I just wanted to check in for a second and suggest that all is not well within the Republican Party. There was a very fascinating article this morning. I thought it was in the New York Times, but I may be wrong, suggesting that some of the people in the House of Representatives, the the technical term is the Meshuggahs are after the Senate to really rev it up and to do all these disgraceful things. And Lindsey Graham says, we're not going to do that.
What disgraceful things?
Mm-hmm. Call out,
subpoena
call
the
Adam
phone
Schiff.
Records of Adam Schiff.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
So and on do, and so forth.
Exactly. So those senators, I've been saying it all along, know not only is this about Trump, it's about them. Mm-hmm. They got to worry about getting kicked out and flipping the Senate. And that's what's really going on here.
What do defense attorneys do when they have a particularly difficult client?
They look to abandon the case as soon as possible. Or they try to feed, in this case, I would have Benadryl cookies for this president.
Yes.
Take his phone. So, let's delve into something, right? In every White House, there would be a room that we would call the war room, right? That would have attorneys, right, in that room, that would have his political advisors, that would have members of his campaign team, and everything would be mapped out, right? For example, I said 2 weeks ago when I was sitting in this chair, I said, you have to watch over the course of the next 2 weeks when you get that decision from the appellate court in D.C. About Trump
McGahn.
And McGahn coming before the Senate, the Assembly, or not the Assembly, the House to testify. You have to watch for that. But you also have to watch for what's happening with Parnum in the Southern District. Mm-hmm. Parnum has been feeding the Intelligence Committee his phone records. He is looking to get out from the thumb of the Southern District, which is, and if you, not many people paid attention to this a few weeks ago, but apparently the actual U.S. attorney for the Southern District was in the courtroom when they were having a hearing about Parnum. Mm-hmm. Now, that never happens.
Mm-hmm. Berman, right?
The actual U.S.
It happens
attorney
on Law and Order.
Is not in the courtroom as these proceedings are going on. So there's a big shoe to drop with Parnum.
David, right? Do you have any predictions on how the speed of this? I mean, we have Rudy Giuliani in Ukraine right now, mm-hmm. presumably doing the same things for which we're looking mm-hmm. at impeachment, and there's no charges against him yet, although he's under investigation. Is there any estimate of when that could happen? That changes things
he
a lot.
He is laying a predicate for his defense, right?
Who is? I'm sorry.
Giuliani, right? Because here's what Giuliani's doing. I know what I did was wrong, but if I do it three or four times, it makes it look like it's just
routine,
and it's a regular thing.
Really?
So
that doesn't make sense.
Tell a drug dealer that.
Exactly.
Steal another car.
Right.
Yeah. That's exactly
it. Didn't work for Manson either, really. You know. Hey, let's take a quick break here. We have a stack of letters that we have not gotten to, and the email address is panel@wamc.org. Rosemary Armeo is here. Aaron Pasitti, David Soares, Judith Henk, and Alan Shartok. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Friday morning. 9:46 is the time. Ray Graff here, and we have a great panel. David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Henk, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. You, of course, can join the fun by emailing us, and many people have done that. This one is from Kevin in Melrose. Question for David. David, does Trump have to testify in a Senate trial?
He doesn't have to testify. As a matter of fact, he can sit back and do what other presidents have done in the past, which is allow for his defense team to go out there and put together a strong defense. In this instance, he is depriving his defense team of putting on the best possible case because his ego will not allow for it.
He'll be live tweeting.
Mm-hmm. Now, and is his defense team still Rudy Giuliani and Jay Sekulow?
Oh, I mean, who wants to raise their hand for that job?
Who's the guy? Pat Cipollone.
Well, he's the White House counsel. He's not his personal attorney.
So he won't be involved in an impeachment?
No, he will be.
He will be in that room. Who the point people are for him, I don't know.
Well,
Working through the rules, Mitch McConnell. They're still
supposedly
developing.
Schumer has a role in that.
Yeah, they're developing what the process is going to be for this hearing. And again, the X factor here is the chief Justice of the United States of America, who is just not going to allow for the politics to run amok.
We hope.
Interesting.
This one came in from Joel in Blooming Grove. Please explain just how will the impeachment of Trump prevent him from soliciting and or accepting help from Russia or anywhere else in the 2020 election? He'll be acquitted in the Senate and will be even more emboldened to be lawless, not more restrained. And that's from Joel.
Joel, there's one thing to look out for as well here. And I don't know how many people have been paying attention to this, but there was the independent report that Bill Barr, an investigation, was working on to determine the origins of the Mueller investigation. Okay, now there was also an independent IG investigation that is at the same time going on, and you remember the U.S. attorney from Connecticut that was appointed by Barr to conduct the special
handpicked
to conduct the special investigation. Well, we got information at the beginning of the week that that report that the IG is publishing. Found that there's absolutely zero evidence that there was spying going on in the Trump campaign.
Now, is the IG the same as the Southern District?
No. He's the Inspector General is the Inspector General. He's
It's not the same report.
Nope. He is the police of the FBI. He's the person that does the independently will deal with issues of corruption, will do investigations, and will give a report. Now, generally speaking, when an IG does a report, you're going to have disagreements with the leadership of that office, and they give you the opportunity to respond to some of the claims. In this instance, before this report is finalized, it was leaked to the press, which tells me that the individuals who are working in the IG's office, or perhaps even the DOJ, has seen this and is leaking to the press because of concern over Bill Barr's ability to spin the findings.
But Barr started spinning already. He said he disagrees with some of the major findings.
Which he's allowed to say, right?
Well, no. A respected attorney general usually does not attack, I know, keyword respected, does not attack an IG report, especially before it comes out, trying to kind of...
Right, but he's allowed to do that, right?
Has he allowed it to come out, Judith?
I don't know if he's allowed to leak parts of an IG report before it's public. No one else could do that.
It's not a matter of being allowed to leak. You're going to get a copy of that report. You're going to get a draft, and then you have X number of weeks to respond to elements that you disagree with, which will also be included in the final report.
But my question is, isn't Barr doing something sneakier, which is to try to prevent or delay the release until it is changed? He's trying to pressure the IG. That was my impression. Is that correct?
I think he's doing that.
He may be trying.
But the step that's being, I mean, the chess match right now is the amount of information that is coming about this report that is flooding, you know, whether it's the Post or the Times, and we're getting it. And that's because people know what he did with the Mueller report. Mm-hmm. They have no confidence and trust in this particular attorney general, and they're creating a channel to get this information out to the public.
Mm-hmm. And you can be sure that he is speaking to the President of the United States.
Can I go back to the letter writer's original question, which is what's going to prevent Trump from doing this in 2020? Trump's history, whether it's business or entertainment, is always pushing the limits. So if you can get away with one thing, then you could try to step further. And you see that with the how the Mueller investigation resolved itself. And now he's pushing the limits with Ukraine. And if he'll likely be impeached, but he won't be removed. So he's going to to the extent that this is already happening, probably going to push it further, would be my guess.
This one is from Bill in Garrison. Joe Biden is the subject heading. Sorry, Rosemary, you're wrong. David is right. Biden was orally attacked by this man and responded appropriately and strongly and did not lose his cool. The media, including NPR, blew it up. But then I watched the video and the audience actually applauded Joe for standing up for himself. And that's from Bill in Garrison.
Oh, a man.
I wanted to go back to David while he's on the stand.
Sure.
We had a question from Mark, who wanted to know exactly what the Chief Justice's role would be in all of this.
He's going to be dealing with evidentiary issues. He's going to be dealing with making sure that whatever laws and rules are developed for these proceedings are going to be strictly adhered to. It's not going to be a kangaroo proceeding. there's also something else that's very important here to understand, and that is the civility of the upper house of Congress. And I'm not prepared to believe that even Lindsey Graham can take all of that, of the history and the reputation, the prestige of the Senate and
Kavanaugh hearing.
Kavanaugh hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going to be crazy town.
And set a blowtorch to it.
Even with John Roberts, I think a lot of the Republicans are still going to make it crazy.
So let's discuss the way in which this works. There is a prosecution, and that prosecution is brought by the House. Am I right about that, David?
Correct.
Okay, so in other words, we don't know who it'll be. Maybe it's going to be Adam Schiff. Who knows? And then there'll have to be a defense, and the defense will be the Republican majority one way or the other. And sitting on top of all of this is going to be the Chief Justice, who's going to say, no, you had your turn, Rosemary, I mean, whoever, and go that way.
There'll be order and decorum in that space. And also you have a judge who's going to be able to make decisions immediately, strike irrelevant testimony, which is one of the reasons why there's absurdity here with Trump looking to call, you know, Biden as a witness or Schiff. It's because what's the relevance of Joe Biden, you know, to this case when the issue is whether or not you withheld, you know, funding?
Tax dollars
that had already been appropriated. That's the issue, whether or not you withheld that to obtain a personal benefit in the form of assistance in attacking your campaign.
Far be it from me to argue, David, the Republican side, but I can just see it coming. They're going to say, wait a second, Biden is central to this. The president says all he was doing was investigating corruption, of which he thinks that the Bidens are part of. Now, I, of course, don't agree with that, but that's going to be their argument, right?
But the beauty of having a chief judge who is going to be able to, that's not the issue. That's his defense. That's going to be the president's defense to the accusation. However, why would you need Joe Biden as a witness? And why would Joe Biden ever cooperate as a witness to the president's defense? What is Joe going to go there and say, yeah, I was a little corrupt?
That's a totally separate case, and if Trump wanted to bring that, then he should have.
Or the senators, when they were in the majority, never
investigated. Aaron, what do you mean he should have? He should have done what?
If Trump was actually concerned about Biden's behavior and Hunter Biden's behavior as well, right. And correct me if I'm wrong, David, I'm guessing there's plenty of legal avenues Trump could have pursued to investigate if there was any wrongdoing.
The President of the United States has within his power and ability the number one investigatory body in the world in the form of the FBI.
Right. Who he hates.
So if Trump wanted to do that, he could have gone through formal channels instead of these backdoor channels of ousting you know, the ambassador to the Ukraine and all of those other
stuff. You know,
Judith, you said instead he went where?
To Rudy Giuliani. Instead of using the FBI and all the intelligence agencies who he doesn't trust, he gave Rudy the assignment to go and figure out the Biden connection, which Rudy failed to do.
Well, but Rudy has protection.
Ray had asked a question earlier, if you were defending this guy, you know, what would that be like? And the answer to that is, When this issue first broke, within a matter of 1 week, he had already had four different explanations. One of them being, you know, we're investigating corruption. Like, he just kept on throwing these things out into the wind, right? Now, if you're defending this guy, if you're his counsel, right, you would have said,
shut up already.
Shut up. Don't say a thing. And I'm going to break your thumbs because I don't want you tweeting. Right? And this guy went out and laid a different predicate for his defense within 1 week.
He's the president of the United States. I can't stand the guy. You know that. Nevertheless, I wouldn't say I hate him, but I'm with Nancy Pelosi. However, he's the president. He got there the way he's been behaving, right? It doesn't matter. I used to have a colleague at the Eagleton Institute of politics who used to say, you know, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. I think that's what he's saying.
No, I think the chickens have come home to roost because he is not in control of everything. For instance, you saw that Deutsche Bank is having to hand over financial records. You have Fiona Hill, you have Bill Taylor, you have even the wacky Gordon Sondland, who decided to eventually tell some of the truth. There's a lot that Trump does not control.
And yet there are a lot of people, Judith, who think he's going to be reelected.
The President of the United States, I'm convinced, and I may be wrong, but I'll be back here for you to throw it in my face if I am. I'm convinced that there will be a prosecution against this president. Once he's no longer in office, he will be prosecuted. So this campaign, to you and I, it might be about who is in the United States White House, but to him, it's about self-preservation and liberty, right? And a future, right? So he's going to go to all extent to defend himself, except he will always be undermined by himself. Because if you were a defense attorney representing this guy, look at how many issues you're currently trying to defend. The financial records that the attorney general of the state of New York wants, right? Because of her investigation. It's Cy Vance's investigation, right? You now have a new lawsuit by one of the women he was having an affair against Fox News. Mm-hmm. And the thing about those lawsuits, although there may be settlement, they want to get to discovery. And everybody's going to be interested in getting to the discovery, right? There's just too many collateral issues, and he has absolutely zero control and zero focus, and he won't listen to counsel.
Do you get to discovery? Do you get to finality until it gets to the Supreme Court of the United States, which is their game, right, David?
Well, the discovery will be done in this civil litigation. The only thing that they can do is what they've been continuing to do, which is delay, delay, delay.
Speaking of that, we're delay, delay, delay on the news. It's a roundtable panel. The email address is panel@wamc.org. David Soares is here. Aaron Pasitti, Judith Ink, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok. We'll be back after news. Welcome back to the roundtable. By the way, I forgot to mention, this is Darling Side we're listening to. They're playing at the Egg on Saturday. That's
beautiful.
Tomorrow at 8 p.m. Theegg.org. You a fan of that, Judith Ink?
I loved it. It calmed me right down.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll try that. Maybe we'll have it on standby for future panels.
It's what we needed in this moment.
Judith Ink is here. David Soares is here. Aaron Pasitti, Rosemary Armeo, and Alan Shartok. And, you know, I love, we should record some of the conversations in the break. We just had a great conversation about The Godfather, which shockingly, Judith Ink has never seen. But you must see it now, right?
I will, over the holidays. Nothing says happy holidays.
That is the best
like
present
the
you could give to yourself over the holiday season.
I just have to say that I'm a bit insulted at the fact
that. Oh, that's pretty good. That's darn good. You got to put the gauze in the mouth, though.
Since Ray calls me something of an economist, I'm going to say, I'm smart, Ray. I'm smart.
Ah, Pasitti, I knew it was you. All right, here we go. U.S. gains a robust 266,000 jobs. Unemployment falls to 3.5%. This is the excitement that our economist, Aaron Pasitti, he can't contain himself.
We need to get you some music, man. I think you need to have an introduction, man.
I was hoping for Isaac Hayes' Hot Buttered Soul.
Hot Buttered Soul.
But,
let's just get to the
numbers.
Okay,
fine. Okay, this was a really pleasant surprise, I think, for everyone. Economists were expecting 180,000 jobs to be added, and the economy added 266,000.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very strong report. So even after you account for the 42,000 GM workers who returned to work after the strike, that still puts the job gains at 224,000. So yeah, this is way above average. The monthly average for 2019 was 180,000 jobs per month. So this is way above that and much more consistent with the exceptionally strong growth from 2018. So you saw increases in manufacturing employment, particularly large gains in health services. So all around, a very strong report.
And Alan, this is good for the Don, right?
You know, I was just going to ask a question of our excellent economist. If you have relative full employment, how can you keep getting more jobs?
Well, businesses need to expand, obviously. I mean, right now, the number of job openings, which are jobs without workers, exceeds the number of unemployed workers. And that's an exceptionally rare instance in U.S. economic history. So the issue there is that the jobs that businesses have open that they can't fill, even though there's, you know, unemployed workers who could work, could be due to the fact that the unemployed workers don't have the skills businesses are looking for, or it could be that businesses are offering, you know, wages lower than workers want. So yeah, we've been at full employment for a very long time. Some economists agree that we could probably still push it further. So it's a very strong report. It's a very strong report. But every economist will tell you, whether it's a really bad report that, you know, in this case would be ammunition for the Democrats, and you have 1 month of an exceptionally strong report, which is ammunition for Republicans, don't make too big a deal out of 1 month's numbers.
Okay, but we're now at a 50-year low for unemployment, 3.5%. When can you start making a big deal about it?
People have been making a big deal about
when
it.
When can our economist make a big deal about it?
Here's why I'm not making that big of a deal about it. When you have unemployment that low, you should really see consistent and accelerating wage growth. That has not been happening.
We've talked about this before. What is the lag between job growth and wage growth? And unemployment drops. And I mean, there has to be a lag
right
there.
So the argument is that if businesses want to fill jobs, they should bid wages up to pull people in.
Immediately, though?
You will
see this immediately.
If businesses have jobs open that they can't fill and want to fill because there's demand for their product, they should be bidding up wages to either poach workers from other firms, to lure workers in off of the sidelines. We have not seen that for the past. I mean, we haven't seen that this entire recovery. The highest wage growth has been since the recovery started in July 2009 has been 3.3%. And it took us, you know, 9 years to get to that.
So it happened last year.
The lag should be a couple months tops. So the only concern in this report is decelerating wage growth. So you had 3.3% in the early part of this year, then it went down to 3.2, and now it's down to 3.1%. Is that a big deal? Not really. But given that, given how many jobs the economy's added, you would expect to see wage growth creep up.
Yeah, now, but to Ray's point, this is good news for Trump, right?
This is very good news for Trump because, you know, myself included, economists have been saying, you know, the trade war with China, the you know, the slowdown in growth in Germany and Japan, you know, the looming Brexit deal, all of these things create uncertainty, which reduces business investment and therefore reduces hiring, have yet to materialize. And, you know, now that Trump's announced new tariffs on Argentinian and Brazilian steel and aluminum, and there's threats of new tariffs against the European Union, I don't know if he's just saying, well, my threats or my actual trade war and tariffs against China hasn't produced a slowdown in growth, so let's just go whole hog on this and keep on imposing tariffs against whomever's on his radar.
He's the only person that sabotages himself.
This is, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm bracing for a full assault on Canadian syrup.
Yeah, right.
Anything Canadian or French. I do want to point out, though, the tariffs impact on agriculture and the federal bailout of big ag, mostly, not mm-hmm. small farmers, is larger than the federal bailout of the auto industry.
Oh, yeah.
So it's... taxpayers are picking up some of that impact of that trade policy.
Well, sure. Somebody reported this morning, right, that there are more bankruptcies among small farmers than ever before.
Oh, yep. it's awful. And yeah. High suicide rates. You've got small family farms.
Crushing debt.
Really.
Can we lay this all on the doorstep of Trump's tariff policies?
With China, yeah, absolutely.
Really? All the suicides of small farmers? Because they haven't been oppressed by large farms for 50 years?
They have been, but this has accelerated that. when Trump imposed tariffs, China imposed tariffs on U.S. agricultural products, knowing that it was going to hit a large swath of his, you know, middle of the country base. Not an accident that China chose to target those goods. And the Wall Street Journal had an interesting expose, I think it was last week or this week, interviewing farmers from, you know, Wisconsin and the Midwest, and they're saying, yeah, this is hurting us, but we still support them. We think this will be good for us in the long run. And
yeah, Alan's mentioned that several times.
Looking into a crystal ball, maybe it will be, maybe it won't. Historically, trade wars are a lose-lose proposition for both parties that
who has more
get
to lose.
Involved into it.
Look, I think I said this morning to someone else I was having a conversation with. You know, in the United States of America, you have the right to do a lot of things like remain silent, but you also have a right to be dumb, right?
Yeah.
And if I can't pay my bill because I'm a soy farmer, and it's because, you know, China's now importing all of soy products from Brazil, right? That's just got an incredible bump in their economy, right? And I'm still saying, oh, I believe in the long run it's going to be great. What's your wife telling you?
Right.
You
know?
Right.
When the gas bill comes, you know, what are you telling that person? Are you saying, I believe in the long run it's going to be great. You'll get your money for the power you've given me, right?
What can Trump claim credit for, actual credit that he's done that wasn't from Obama or...
Sure. Well, the U.S. economy is like an oil tanker, and you can't make it change direction, you know, with one specific policy. It takes a lot of time, and there's usually, you know, a half a year up to, you know, like a 2 or 3 year lag from tax cuts or changes in monetary policy. So the macroeconomy has a lot of inertia in that, you know, the decreasing unemployment and the job gains we had from 2009 into the Trump presidency are just the result of a really strong growing economy that's in the longest expansion in U.S. economic history. Can Trump take credit for that? Well, as much as Obama can.
I think he can take credit for is an unprecedented growth in the fossil fuel industry.
Sure.
He has rolled back key environmental regulations. He hasn't saved coal. Coal is dying.
Oh, yeah.
But there's more and more hydrofracking, oil production, exporting energy. It's having a devastating environmental effect because it's happening at the same time when the EPA is no longer enforcing environmental laws the way they used to.
But, you know, but with oil and extraction industries, those prices are determined in a world market. So that boom in employment you got from pulling back those environmental restrictions and, you know, legalizing fracking in Pennsylvania, it created a short-term boost. But when oil prices tanked in, what was it, 2015, 2016, employment in those industries plunged, and now there's a rebound. And
it's
very volatile.
They're not huge job creators, so the fracking boom has also led to the construction of ethane cracker facilities in Pennsylvania and beyond to build. They provide the ingredients for single-use plastic packaging. It's not a lot of jobs. It's a huge amount of federal subsidy.
Did you say ethane
cracker facilities. People need to learn about these. There are hundreds of these proposed in Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, Texas, and Louisiana. And it's taking the byproduct of fracking, sending it by pipeline to a new industrial facility. The newest one is run by Shell in Pennsylvania to make single-use plastic packaging cheaper than it is today. What's interesting is these are multi-billion dollar facilities, but once you get past the construction jobs, very few jobs are created.
Well, I mean, and then there's the downstream effect of, you know, industries that support those industries and industries that support the supporting industries
and all the plastic
and so on.
In the ocean.
You know, I mean, that's the one thing economists are starting to pay attention to is that there's good growth and there's bad growth. And bad growth comes from things that pollute the environment, growth that creates products that are destructive, you know, the military industrial complex.
Climate change impacts.
So those are not factored into
this
employment
economic
numbers.
Report has nothing on climate change impacts.
And, yeah, so when you hear the, you know, GDP report, it just says the economy grew, but it doesn't say whether it grew for right reasons that are going to be sustainable in the long term. It could have grown because of the creation of single-use plastic facilities.
And yet when you're talking about electoral politics, it doesn't matter, does it? That's the point.
Well, it does, but so economists and political scientists have looked at how the economy affects elections. And it really boils down to what happens in the couple months preceding an election.
Absolutely.
Presidents can claim, well, in 2016, the unemployment rate started coming down and wage growth was highest in 2018. What voters care about is what happens in the couple months preceding an election. So even though the unemployment rate is at a 50-year low at 3.5%, if it goes up to, 3.8 or 4%, even though that is still exceptionally low by historical standards, that is a strike against the incumbent president. And the flip side is, if you have super high unemployment, say 10%, and it drops to 9.5%, that's a boon for the incumbent. So what matters isn't the level of unemployment and the level of economic growth, it's how it changes in the months preceding an election.
But the Democrats have to worry about being seen as people who are basically hoping for a downturn in any of those indices you just mentioned.
I hope Democrats don't feel that, because I don't feel that. I mean, so some narrow self-interest in me says, I would hope Trump doesn't get reelected, but I hope it doesn't take a recession where you have millions of unemployed workers who are struggling to make ends meet to make that happen.
I don't think the Democrats really have to spend a lot of energy focusing on unemployment at all, because this guy gives them so many other bigger things that captures the every news cycle.
One of the things that I've been concerned with economically, and I don't know if economists have looked at this, is the long-term effect of Americans' economic withdrawal from the world. That void is being so filled by China, which has moved in very scary ways into Eastern Europe and Africa and South America.
Well, that was the whole, I think the Obama administration went into the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations with probably mixed emotions, knowing that these free trade agreements are really detrimental to manufacturing workers, but it's how we get our, hands on policy that's going to affect a part of the world where China is gaining extreme influence at a very rapid rate. Mm-hmm. The other thing that the unemployment report and any economic statistic doesn't tell you
is that he stretched his economic report.
Good Lord. This will be quick. I'm gonna go get a cup of coffee.
This will be quick. Yeah.
I think the job numbers changed already.
What's been going on since the 1980s has been the rise in income inequality, and all of the income gains since 1980 have gone to the richest 10% of the population. So people making six figures and above have really been the only part of the workforce who has benefited from any economic policy beginning in the late 70s and early 1980s.
So
the bottom 90% has seen their incomes either stagnate or decline, adjusted for the cost of living.
And to me, this is amazing. The perfect storm. You have a president that is receding from his responsibilities in the world, right? You have the wealth gap. Mm-hmm. We now have a world where you have more
concentration.
Greater concentration of wealth, but it's also giving rise to populism in every corner of the world.
Yep. What do you mean?
Well, less democratic nations. We seem to have the right who is running on populism in Poland. You know, Europe, Italy is. You're going to have some guy by the name of Mussolini coming back and taking over. But Italy and their economy.
And what's remarkable is that this populism is the politicians that the voting populists are voting for are the ones imposing policies that make them worse off.
Absolutely.
It's incredibly self-defeating, and economists and philosophers and sociologists and political scientists are scratching their heads saying, well, if these are your concerns, that's fine that Donald Trump has said, I'm going to bring back coal jobs. I'm the hero of the blue collar worker. What policy has he implemented that has done anything to advance their economic interests? And why are they going to vote for them?
Nothing matters unless they say, those people who are most affected, yes, this is going to change my vote. And so far, we don't see that happening. David said before, people have a right to be stupid. Maybe so. The idea that Trump is going to be reelected is so abhorrent to me that I can't even say. But Until there's an understanding on the part of those people who have been disenfranchised that they're in trouble, you don't get a change.
No, they were the same people who voted for Ronald Reagan.
But what's interesting, in the last election, a lot of the Trump voters also said that it had Bernie Sanders been the candidate, they may have voted
but
for Bernie.
But he's a populist as well.
You can't compare Bernie Sanders.
I'm not comparing them. But
populism.
Okay,
you
I'm not comparing them. I'm not comparing them. But give me a break when Elizabeth Warren says, "Okay, we're gonna have health care for everybody." Wait a second. The better part of my life, I've watched Hillary Clinton, I've watched President Obama tackle the issue of health care, right? And it was a miracle that we ended up passing it. But here we have people that are promising the world, right? Because that's what they do. That's what populist people
do. To give everyone health care.
You can express aspirational goals. That's fine.
But it's not aspirational. Every other industrialized country in the world does this. So why is it infeasible in the U.S., which is the wealthiest country in the world?
Can you do that? Elizabeth Warren is president of the United States in 2020 or 2021. She takes office. Tell me how we're getting universal health care for everybody in the United States.
How do we slip from Bernie to Elizabeth?
Because he's the same thing.
Plan is not in 1 year. It's stretched out.
Sure.
I'm talking about having control of the House.
Yeah, right.
Having control of the Senate. Oh.
Talking about health care is what gets you control of the House and the Senate. Healthcare is a human right. It should not be controversial.
We're not having
that Democratic candidates are saying they're working for universal
health care. We are not having a conversation about whether it's a universal right. That's not the debate. The debate is, can you make it happen?
Economically, yes. If you raise income taxes and corporate taxes back to where they were under the Reagan years, after mm-hmm. his tax cuts, we could have enough money to not only fund Medicare for all, but fund Social Security for the next 75 years.
Run
a balanced budget for the next 10 years. So economically, it's 100% feasible.
Wow.
No question about it.
So that's
However,
true.
Politically, it's going to be a challenge.
Yeah.
So
because
that's
not
for me to decide. That's for politicians to decide.
You currently have a MAGA-wearing truck driver in Michigan,
right.
Okay, who's losing his house 8 months from today, who still stands there and says, you know what, these NFL players, they're
kneeling down.
We got to go over Trump, That's the problem. The problem is you still have a country that is so divided, right, amongst – down every line, whether it's race, grievances, economics, right? And for us to imagine that all of a sudden we're gonna create these aspirational goals and it's going to be transformative and without some fundamental change.
But remember that the Republicans' aspirational goals of massive personal and corporate taxes in the early 1970s was entirely aspirational. Look what's happened to tax rates since then. It took a decade plus for those tax cuts to start being chiseled down. And it didn't happen overnight. It happened over four decades.
We need to make sure that we state that, there are many truck drivers who are very thoughtful, smart people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, many of my relatives.
And there's a lot of dumb economists, too.
Ray just went over the top with a little salt for Mr. Fuji in my eyes.
There you go. And don't forget Tanaka. Fuji and Tanaka, right.
It's Mouth of the South, Jimmy
Hart. We should just call this four Democrats in a studio getting coffee, because you guys are just arguing. It's beautiful. It's a great thing. It's been a lot of fun to listen to. And frankly, there's more of it. I don't know how much more we can take. Panel@WAMC.org is the email address. This one came in from Daniel. Biden's loss of control, and there's no other way to characterize it, was a display of weakness that is a terrible character trait for a world leader who will need to endure much harsh criticism. It's not a quality of strength.
And there's more of it to come, so he needs to buckle up and figure out how to deal with it.
As I said, quoting myself before, you can't have it both ways. You can't be telling the guy you got to get up there and you got to fight and you got to tell people you don't like what they're saying, and or you got to be what you've been and people don't like that. So I think that's a tough one.
This one is from Eileen. As we know, turning things around in this country could be strongly dependent on suburban women. Mm-hmm. Nancy's example of calmly stating the facts and reacting solidly. David, what's going on over there? Did you lose something?
Yes.
I dropped my cookie, okay?
Oh, there it is.
Oh. Hang on. We'll get to Eileen. You know, it should be noted... It should be noted that our economist brought in cookies. What's the deal with this?
So my wonderful mother-in-law, Linda Slack, bakes gingerbread cookies every holiday season with red-hot eyes, and they're so good that David just stopped listening to Ray about 2 minutes ago.
Most
to look
people
for his
stopped
lost
years
cookie.
Ago. So
just, well, I was going to say.
I
dropped my cookie. That's the quote of the day.
But, you know, these gingerbread cookies have, in passing, have a Gumby look to them. You know?
They do,
they
kind of do.
They sort of look like...
So don't thank me. Thank my mother-in-law, Linda.
Ginger
thank
Gumbies.
You, Linda.
Maybe we can get Sarah LaDuke to post the recipe.
For the cookies?
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know if that's proprietary.
Because, you know,
I'll ask.
Because, you know, she's not busy at all, by the way.
That's what
so
I figured.
We'll just put recipes up now. Okay, very quickly. We only have about 30 seconds before the news. This is back to Eileen's letter. As we know, turning things around in this country could be strongly dependent on suburban women, Nancy's example, of calmly stating the facts and reacting solidly to the accusation of hate is what we need to see more of and could potentially influence those suburban women away from Trump and toward a Democratic solution. This gives me hope that we might actually turn this around, and that's from Eileen.
Yeah, she was just beautiful. Yep. She was powerful, and she stood up for herself. So you can do both. You can stand
be
up
like
for yourself
Nancy.
And be strong. Yes.
And remember that reporter she has history with. He's from Sinclair, and she's been trying to bait. He's been trying to bait her before, and she was having none of it.
Right. And let's remember one of the things that was so interesting was her invocation of her Catholic faith.
Right.
I thought it was brilliant, too.
All right, let's take a break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Rosemary, David, Alan, Judith, we'll be back.
When the world speaks, it rattles to me like an antique. Or maybe it rings like an old bell, wishing us some kind of farewell. A wave in the window, a beacon, the batten down and pass.
Welcome back to the Roundtable on a Friday morning, 10:34. Ray Graff with you. That was Darling Side. They'll be at the Egg tomorrow, theegg.org. If you'd be interested in finding out more, you can do it right there. This is one of my favorite panels because the breaks are hilarious. We have Albany County District Attorney David Soares here, Siena College professor, and something of an economist, Aaron Pasitti, is here. A senior fellow, visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Ank is here. Investigative journalist, retired Mahjong player, Rosemary Armeo is here. And WAMC's Alan Shartok is here as well. The stack continues to grow. So let's blast through it.
You got a lot.
You see what I'm saying?
We have to stop talking.
Book.
Yeah, this is, we'll just read a few and we'll talk, we'll chat, we'll have some coffee, right? We'll break
coffee
a few
talk.
Cookies together. From the start, Biden is, this is from Daisy. From the start, Biden has acted like the nomination is owed to him, and he acts like the primary process is beneath him. I suggest you all read George Packer's The Unwinding if you want a true glimpse of Biden. He is hardly lovable Uncle Joe. Yeah. He can be a thin-skinned bully, and that fact is clearer every day. That's from Daisy.
Man, Daisy,
that was written
Daisy got a lot
before,
of venom.
Yeah.
Daisy's
The Packard book that they recommend was written before the 2016 election. It is so predictive of what has happened and where we are now. Great book.
This one is from Teresa. Rosemary and Judith are totally right. Pelosi was the essence of smart and tough. Biden came off as a pathetic old guy trying to be tough.
Exactly.
Interesting that the men liked it but turned the women off.
Exactly.
And who's going to swing the next election? Women in the suburbs.
It's like professional wrestling. The men love it and the women are turned off.
Or the Three Stooges.
Yes,
men
true.
Like it, women know it's stupid.
Or Lethal Weapon, too.
Hold it.
Exactly.
Now, hold it.
Or just life.
The Stooges brought stupid to an art form. There is a practiced brilliance to the stupidity.
Well, then we could get into the Big Lebowski, too.
Well, that's a great movie. It's one of the great movies of all time.
That's on the...
He's a big environmental activist, yeah.
I know, I like that part of him. I love him, and I've watched the movie three times, really trying to find it brilliant, and it's so silly.
That movie really pulled my life together.
Come on,
man. Like the rug. Oh, come he's on, so
man.
Cute. Oh.
You know what? I've had it. Let's go back to the letters. This is from Marcy. Hunter gifted job by Putin. Does anyone else think that Putin, who we know plays chess and the long game, set the story up by setting up Biden by getting Hunter to get this job? How better to hurt Biden than through his son? It's true to Putin's cruel game. He thought 6 years ahead, preparing to take down his rivals, and he has spoon-fed this to Trump. Putin is the great evil with his sick brilliance.
The Kiev Post has a story out this week. Their editor's an American, actually, and it traces this story to a fixer that Rudy Giuliani is using right now. He was a Ukrainian, but raised by his parents in Canada, where they were embassy officials. And he has been connected with all the oligarchs. He has fed this story. It's so all connected, and it has been very long form. So, that's exactly true.
So Trump is right about Trudeau.
All right.
I've been saying all along it's Putin.
There's no coincidences.
I've been saying all along it's Putin. I think Putin.
It's all tied in. Putin has targeted Ukraine, and we have just, or the administration has fallen right into it.
And who's that woman who said all things lead to Putin?
Exactly.
Directly
who's
to Trump?
Who's the one said, you're the puppet?
This one is from Jonathan. Dem versus GOP styles. What you are discussing boils down to whether Dems need to reassert itself as a testosterone-fueled GOP light or whether it should be a more feminine, parentheses meaning intelligent, version. Me, I'm fed up with the testosterone, empty-headed rule by the first fist-first version. Get the women in the room and let them be in charge. That's from Jonathan.
Yes.
Yay,
Jonathan.
Jonathan.
Thank you.
It's not unreasonable.
It's not unusual.
Every house I've ever lived in, man, that's the way it was.
Well, look at who's saving democracy. It's Sally Yates, kicked it off.
Yep.
Fiona Hill, the Yovanovitch, the ambassador. The law professor from Stanford. What is her name?
So they're all the saviors of democracy, are they?
They are. They are
Mount Rushmore.
Brave.
All right, this
one. Yeah, why aren't there any women on Mount
Rushmore?
Well,
there's plenty of room.
And how about the bridges? None are named after women.
Really? Is that true?
That's a problem. Name a bridge named after a woman.
How about a Judith Henke Bridge? Right? Sustainable bridge?
I want Harriet on the money. I want to see currency that has a woman on it.
All right, this one's from Naomi. Naomi writes to our wonderful panel, apparently listening to a different station, adding 100 jobs, 1,000 jobs, or a million jobs that are low-wage subsistence jobs does not make a good economy. The continual case that the American economy is in good shape is absurd and incorrect. Every time a low-wage job is added, the wealth gap widens.
This is true.
It's not true. Is it better to have a job or that pays poorly or no job?
So, I mean, yes, but
great answer.
There are aspirational issues in terms of what policymakers can do to create good jobs. You could raise the minimum wage to a living wage. You could mandate that all employees, part-time or otherwise, full-time, have access to employer-sponsored health care and retirement plans. There are plenty of policies that could be put in place. We've chosen not to do that.
Organized labor is the key.
Right. I was going to say the rise of low-quality jobs is the flip side of a declining union movement.
Putting all those things you said as gospel and possible and doable, it is better to have a job than not have a job, right?
Not in the wealthiest country in the world in the history of world civilization during the country's longest economic expansion.
The
fact that we can't create good jobs for even the lowest skilled people is an abomination.
Wow. Yay.
See, I'm
I'm with him.
From now on, this area where I'm sitting right here is the amen corner, because it's going to be like a Baptist church.
Yeah.
Like
right.
A Baptist church. I'm going to that's all
nice.
I'm going to do.
That's really nice. Mike in Wappingers Falls writes, we are not merely fighting to win the issues on the table at this moment. We are fighting for good and right and decency. If we cannot win without giving up these principles, then we have already lost. It is important to remember that even if we do win by reducing ourselves to their level, it will not be possible to turn around and do right after the fact. It takes a certain number of decent people to run a decent country. If we don't have that number, then the Republic has already failed. We must put all of our efforts toward winning with decency. No other path leads to meaningful victory. And that's from Mike.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just, my whole position is this. You know, again, you're showing up and you're fighting, you know, Mr. Fuji, and you're using the Marquise of Queensberry rules, you know? Let's understand.
I don't know what that means.
I hate that Michelle Obama comment about we take the high road, because that's, Democrats have done that and they have lost. So I get it in principle. But I think that the answer is a new way that shows strength but with dignity. Yeah. And we did see that with Nancy Pelosi yesterday. It is possible.
And remember, at some point, Donald Trump is going to be gone, whether it's 2020 or a few years later. We need to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And the way to do that is to have honest debates like we're having today on health care, on climate change, on education, right, on guns. I mean, my worry is how America survives post-Trump. Will we be more divided?
I just miss Obama, man. I really do.
Know.
And this was, you know, I mean, to Judith's point, the Green New Deal that was... I can't follow this. It's something
no.
serious.
No, drama. Yes,
the, you know, the Green New Deal that was released, which is, again, yeah, a platform, largely aspirational, but at least it's a roadmap of saying, here are right, some things we can work toward. Right. And I think that's a good step forward. Republicans did this in the early 70s about, you know, undoing the social safety net, undoing the New Deal.
Gingrich's,
and it took a long time, but Gingrich's, there was a roadmap. There was a plan.
Gingrich's plan. What was that called again?
Oh, Contract with America?
Yeah, Contract Lunch. On America.
Lunch.
He
hey,
had his contract on America, and where's ours?
Alan, what do you think?
Well...
You're eating, aren't you? You're having
your
a sandwich.
It's peanut butter. It's peanut butter.
Caught
well,
him.
You found me out.
All right.
Okay, but here's what. I truly believe that we have to remember this is a moderate country.
is it honey walnut? Are you this having is, honey walnut
this
on
is,
your
this
bagel?
This is a moderate country.
Yeah.
We have a blue House of Representatives because moderates got elected. So the argument that it's all or nothing is just wrong. It isn't all or nothing. It's a question of the Democrats coming up with something that is reflective of what the population of the United States is feeling. So that's my sense of it.
This one is from Lisa. I'm so sick of people berating Biden. Compare him to Warren's fool. Would he cheat on Jill, cage babies, let them die, lie every time he opens his mouth? Warren can't win, and Bernie's a joke. Sounds like Rosemary wants 4 more years of Orange Fool. And that's from Lisa in Pokewad.
Whoa.
Oh, bite me. Come on, there's no way that I'm for Trump. Yeah, really, that's silly.
What kind of an answer is
that?
She it's
was,
the same that Biden gave. That's what kind of answer
she
is.
Was
that's
the president
foolishness.
Of the debating club. That's.
Oh, I see. So if he did it, you should do it, right?
Well, you support it, so I tried it.
All right.
I think that was called irony. Is what Rosemary
exactly.
just did.
Right. Thank you. You are pretty astute.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm uncomfortable with this little...
Exactly.
I actually pay attention to what's going on.
Thank you.
It's like the axis of evil over here, investigative journalism and economics.
All right, this is from Tom. When Speaker Pelosi responded to that reporter's question about hatred, I was floored. She demonstrated the highest ideals to which every human alive needs to value. The manner of her response demonstrated strength that our president could only wish he had. Speaker Pelosi is a role model for all young people today. And that is from Tom.
Yeah, he's right. Tom's right.
I agree with that too. And I you know, there is something to be said, because I think the hardest job for the president, the next president, is going to be unifying this country. Mm-hmm. When this man was first elected, I said, you know, the path to reclaiming the White House was going to have to lead through the Democrats continuing to advocate for the things that people need, right? Jobs, you need security, you need to feel hopeful, right? Those aren't messages that you have to really work and refine and try to target certain people in certain parts mm-hmm. of the country. That's a global unifying message, you know? And I'm hopeful that the Republican Party finds a center and tethers themselves to the ideals.
Right, what makes you think that can happen? David, what makes you think that's going to happen? There's not one scintilla of evidence that that party is moving off the dime.
I don't. What I'm saying is, I said I'm hopeful. I am hoping
based on what that
could happen, because their power. I mean, their power really lies in the center of our country, right? And as long as people in the center of our country continue to experience suffering as a result of certain tariffs and the lack of industry, they're always going to appeal to this populist sort of ideology as opposed to, you know, restoring the vibrancy of our economy and our country.
I mean, and that strain of populism in the center of the country goes back to the 19th century, and I'm not going to bore people with the bimetallic standard, but they were crushed by economic policies that increased their debt levels. So that's nothing new.
By the what standard?
The bimetallic standard.
Oh, I thought you said Biden metallic.
No.
The Biden metallic standard.
This one is Biden metallica.
Biden.
Yeah, this one's from Daniel. Fat shaming. Biden fat shamed that voter. We already have a president who does crap like that. Jeez, that's from Daniel.
Does anybody remember, because I read that, does anybody remember exactly what the fat shaming was like? Did he say something, shut your big fat mouth, or something like that?
I think he called the guy fat.
Oh, push-ups.
The push-up contest.
Yeah,
I only heard it. I didn't see what the voter looked like.
All right, one more letter here. This one's from Rob in Pittsfield. Rob says, so President Trump increased aid to Ukraine in 2017 and 18, including the sale of Javelin missiles. Theoretically, he has aided Ukraine more than Obama. My question is, as he was sending hundreds of millions of dollars in aid and weapons for the past 2 years, why didn't any of this corruption come up in 2017 and 2018? I think the answer is obvious. I haven't heard anyone in Congress ask this question, though maybe they have. And that's from Rob.
Rob, no one asked that question because no one needed to ask that question, Rob. Come on, Rob. Okay. Where you been at, Rob? You watching the news, Rob?
This one's from Michael. I guess we have time for this is it. This will be the last one. I suspect he will focus on corruption in general and not the Bidens, and then they will say that was his focus all along. And I'm afraid we have time not for your thoughts on this. We are out of time. I know, Alan.
Why are you stopping?
Go back to your sandwich. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
It wasn't a sandwich.
Bagel?
All right, it's a bagel then.
It was capon.
What the hell?
I don't even know. Yeah.
All right. I don't even want to know. That's the end of the show. David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Thank, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for listening and joining in on the panel. And I apologize to the hundreds of people who didn't get their emails read. Hey, them's the breaks. You know, we'll be back on maybe not Monday, because there is a hearing Monday, but we'll be back on Tuesday and we'll do it all again. You are listening to the Roundtable, and there's more ahead.